Well, I don't know about you, Phil, but I spent my weekend labouring. I was swinging a sledgehammer around because we're having an extension built at some point soon, hopefully, on the house. But we've got to do a bit of demo first. So I was getting a bit of anger management out.
You've basically been taking your frustrations out on some concrete, is it?
Yeah, I'd recommend it. You know, if you've got any work going on, just get stuck in.
Well, yeah, we have had a bit of work going on, actually. We've had a drain being dug up at the front of the house. Luckily, no skeletons down there. But while they were actually looking at the drain, we've had a problem with the toilet downstairs. So there's a ban on using it for number twos. But I think one of the kids had used it because they flushed the toilet to test it was working and where the water was going. And lo and behold, a little brown deposit went floating past.
I don't know where to go from there. Hello, dear listener. I'm Hannah Clark.
And I'm Phil Maiden, and welcome to The Ag Show.
Good to have you on this podcast, with Charlotte taking a well-earned break.
Yeah, well, hopefully, Hannah, I can do her justice.
Coming up on this episode, we'll hear about the work of our exports team and how they continue to champion our produce around the world.
Looking at dynamics around the world, whether that's, you know, population numbers, projected GDP growth, what consumption is going to do in individual markets, and again, how the regulatory landscape lands in terms of gaining access.
We'll also be finding out about the planting and variety survey and how you can help shape the early estimates of this year's harvest.
The idea here is to give people a little bit of an earlier look at what could be coming. And then you're thinking about, with some of our other information that AHDV produces, what stocks are likely to be held at the end of June.
A reminder, new episodes of The Ag Show drop every Wednesday at midday, and they are available wherever you get your podcasts.
With audio and video versions for every show, just subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode.
And please do get in touch with us as always. We really want to hear your stories, what you're getting up to on farm, in the supply chain, wherever. Comment on any of our social posts or email agshow@ahdb.org.uk.
Let's start this week with a look at the work of our exports team. Earlier this year, we highlighted the news that the global appetite for UK dairy and red meat had seen exports hitting a record high of £4 billion last year.
And it got us thinking about what work goes behind the scenes from an HDB point of view to help reach these record highs. International Trade Development Director Jonathan Eckley is back with us on The Ag Show alongside Lucy Randolph, our Head of International Trade Development for Dairy. So guys, on the face of it, it was a big year for trade in 2025, but could you take us through some of the detail?
Yeah, thanks Hannah. Great to be back. Look, it was a strong year, that record value, first time that both the meat sector went through 2 billion just, and dairy exports in value increased by 17% to 2.2 billion. So look, that's a great place to be, driven by demand in a number of markets. You know, not forgetting there are a few challenges around the world right now, but across the sectors, you know, there's a mix in the meat sectors of higher volumes, particularly of sheep meat and pork. Now, some of the values in the pork market are challenging in Asia, and we're probably all quite familiar with tight cattle supplies. So while cattle was down, the value was actually up. So robust demand driven there by a number of markets on those sectors. And I'll let Lucy come to dairy just in a second. But just a market that remains critically important to us is obviously across the channel in Europe. So in the meat sectors, 81% of our exports were destined for the EU, and I think it was about 74% for dairy. So those markets remained critically important, but obviously spreading the risk, looking further afield, is also part of the work the team do. But Lucy, I don't know if you just want to add a bit on the dairy success last year.
Yeah, I think that, we had a really, really big year, a huge jump for us on the dairy side of it. Cheese was up 9.4%. Interestingly, so was milk powders. So skim milk powders are up sort of over 50%, obviously from a slightly lower base than cheese. But it's really interesting to see what's going on around the world. And I think that in terms of the markets, you know, up until recently, you know, we found that cheese has been the big one and it will continue to be. And I think that is why the Europe is such a big one for us and will always be a big one. But I think in terms of potential, and we'll probably talk about this a bit more, but, you know, about demographics and potential for increase in spending and all that kind of thing, will actually, the markets outside of that are the ones for growth. So, and I think that's key. And whilst, you know, we are looking to changing that with the whole potential SBS agreement and things that are coming along, and it'll help us in Europe, we're still very, very keen on expanding outside of that.
So there's been quite a lot of success there. And we've mentioned a few kind of priority markets and areas where we're focusing as a team, as HDB. I think that leads us on nicely just to mention the market access prioritization report that was published recently for 2025. Could you take us through a little bit of detail on what went into that report and kind of where we're focusing?
Yeah, so that report was released last month, and it's the second edition of this report, following on from the first one in 2023. You know, the first thing we have to be able to export is we have to have an export health certificate in place, and the market access work, which we are involved with very much in supporting government as the competent authority who are responsible for opening and maintaining access. So firstly, the role ASDB plays is providing evidence into that. But it's really important, and it's a great example of some collaborative work with industry and government, that we know which markets we're targeting. So the basis of that report is looking at dynamics around the world, whether that's, you know, population numbers, projected GDP growth, what consumption is going to do in individual markets, and again, how the regulatory landscape lands in terms of gaining access. And that all comes together to enable us to work with government and industry to align the priorities for that market access work. And that sits in front of the development work that Lucy's team and my team are involved with of gaining that access in the first place. And we have some mature markets and we have some newer markets. But that access work and that report really underpins being able to export. We've successfully, as a country, opened a number of markets over the last many years, really, since probably the early 2000s, and that's in a really good place. But it's also really important that once you've got access, that you maintain access so you can continue trading with those countries. So that's part and parcel of that work as well.
So you mentioned earlier, Jono, that the EU is still a big market, but the US is one of those that you've started to open up more access to?
Yep. So access to the US has come on stream in recent years, particularly for beef and lamb. You will probably have heard about there was not a full trade deal, but the UK-US agreed a prosperity deal last year. And from our sector's point of view in the meat sectors, on the 1st of January this year, a dedicated quota for UK beef access opened up, which is a great opportunity. Look, it was really complicated landscape, some of these trade deals, and this is not market access. This is how we actually trade. And that is a complex landscape, and you'll be familiar with that because we will have heard the word tariff bandied about an awful lot over the last 12 months. But that 13,000 tonnes, which is a two-way reciprocal quota, does give an opportunity for UK beef exporters to maximise what that market potential is. Now, right now, you know, we've got tight cattle supplies, as the US have. So, you know, it's still a challenging landscape. But without that dedicated quota, it's been very, very challenging to actually do business over the last couple of years. So it's a great opportunity, and some exporters are already availing themselves of that.
And you talk about it being reciprocal. So how do we in the US differentiate ourselves when we're selling to each of those markets?
That quota will lend itself to high quality, high value beef. And obviously the UK climate, for example, is the perfect climate. As we tell a lot of our international people, it quite often rains here. Such a great place to be growing sustainable, high quality beef. And that's that sort of market that we will be targeting over there, with the story and the heritage behind it, as well as our world-leading standards of animal welfare and production, which are some of the best in the world, which really help us underpin that story in that high-value market. But we should also just probably mention, because everybody knows I'm passionate about it in the meat sector, is the carcass balance as well. So particularly while we've got these high cattle prices, it's really important as a sector we can maximise every part of the carcass. So of course that US quota gives us an opportunity for some high value cuts into food service, for example. But we also want to sell some cuts that have a lower demand here in the UK to markets that value them. And, you know, in the pork sector, Asia is a really good example of that. Well, last year we took a number of exporters out to Senegal and Ghana, and those markets are looking much more for fifth quarter products that are much more affordable. And if we don't have big demand from there, it's you know, it's really useful to try and develop those markets so we can actually sell 100% of what we have.
And Lucy, what about dairy in the US?
Interestingly, we don't have the same issues on the red meat side for market access. As John has said, I think it's more sort of trade access sides of it. But we do have other frustrations. So things like the TRQs into Canada, which is the amount that we are able under the system that we are able to actually export over there, and who has that quota, who holds it, and who can bring it into the country. So that's a constant one for us. Actually, as an example, at the moment, we're looking at Indonesia at the moment. So we're moving forward a country audit for applications for the handful of exporters that we've got that want to export to the market. So we need to actually bring them over. But once we've done that first sort of country audit for it, we'll be down to desk audit. So any future applications will mean that they'll just go through a desk audit and they'll be able to export to a country like Indonesia. We have that in sort of lots of other different markets as well. Jonathan has spoken about the US. So, you know, the US for us, we have challenges with the tariff system because obviously, you know, we've got exporters and buyers and retailers over there who are unsure as to what the pricing is going to be at any one time. So that's an interesting one for us to navigate. And the US is a really, really key market. And we're still seeing that British products are really important for US retailers as well, and they're really keen to work with us to try and overcome some of those issues. So I think that we're in a good place in order to be able to do that.
Lucy, it's really interesting to hear, I guess, that some of the challenges and differences that market access and trade development in dairy and how that differs to red meat. But I guess one thing that's affecting all markets at the moment to some degree is the conflict in the Middle East.
It is a real issue at the moment. And I think that for us, it's been incredibly important having our overseas network involved in this. So we've actually got a representative in the Middle East. He's been with us sort of 18 months now. He's been going great guns to sort of increase what we're doing in the Middle East. And you can see that by the figures. I mean, we're up hugely. It's our second biggest export market now. Since this has started, he's been able to keep his ear on the ground as to what is going on over there, what ports are open, you know, where things are being tracked from. And he's actually been effectively blogging out to the exporters. He sent out sort of two or three updates to them as to what he's hearing, where they're being able to source products from. You know, some of the main markets into the main ports in the UAE aren't working, but they're able to get it in elsewhere, and it's being tracked across land. I think the last one that he said is actually Kuwait is really struggling at the moment. That seems to be the most hit of all three of them in terms of being able to bring products in. What we're finding is those who've got a volume going out into the market seem to be finding different ways to be able to get the product in. It's more the sort of small one pallet here, one pallet there going in through air freight that's had the most disruption going into the market. And of course, you've got price increases, huge price increases because of different modes of transport and different ways of being able to get product into the market. However, they do have the ability over there in the Middle East to just get on with things. And things are very much, from what I understand, happening as normal. You know, they're still going out, they're still shopping, they're still willing to pay, and they still want the products that they want to have for those that are actually living over there. So I think they are fairly well placed, hopefully, should things ease, to come out of this. It'll take a couple of months probably to start getting things back to normal if the ceasefire holds. But I think that, you know, they're very well placed to hit the ground running once things hopefully ease up.
Yeah, it's incredibly volatile, isn't it? And things are changing by the hour.
Well, that feels like a good place to pause. Thanks, Jono and Lucy. We're going to come back to you later in the show. But when we come back, we're going to be talking about the planting and variety survey.
Hi, I'm Alice Perry with the latest from AHDB for the week commencing the 25th of May. Our chair, Emily Norton, has responded to the latest Farm Assurance Review Progress Report, highlighting work on 14 key recommendations and continued efforts alongside industry partners to support changes within the farm assurance schemes. We've also published a joint paper with the NFU outlining the purpose, scope, and value of farm assurance. New opportunities for UK agri-food exports will follow the UK's trade deal with the Gulf Cooperation Council. Tariffs are to be removed on products including dairy, cereals and lamb, helping improve competitiveness in a region where demand for high-quality imports continues to grow. And farmers have the chance to get ahead on environmental planning with our new series of baselining roadshows. The countrywide events happening in June will provide practical guidance on measuring and understanding farm data. That's all for now. Find out more at ahdb.org.uk.
Welcome to AHDB's Forage for Knowledge update for Thursday the 21st of May. This week's average growth at 63 kilos of dry matter per hectare is lower than the same period in previous years. With slurry and fertiliser applications going on, it's worthwhile thinking about what else could be limiting grass growth. Are your soils working at their optimum, be that biologically, structurally or chemically? Liming and correcting suboptimal pH opens the possibilities of increasing availability of NPK and S from biological or chemical sources. Also, to capture the full potential of clover to reduce bagged nitrogen, pH needs to be 6.5. Check and lime if necessary. On grass quality, the averages this week have been 20.3% dry matter, 12.3 ME, 20.9 protein. I'm Emily Udall. For more analysis and commentary from Piers Badnall, go to the AHDB website and search Forage for Knowledge.
You're listening to The Ag Show with me, Hannah, and stand-in host, Phil. Yes, that's right, Charlotte is taking some well-earned rest, so I'm joined by Phil. And there's only one thing, really, we're talking about in the news this week. Cereal and oilseed rape growers, please take note, because we are after your information to build an early picture of this year's harvest in the UK.
That's right. Our annual planting and variety survey is open. And to tell us more, it's the aptly named Helen Plant, AHDB's lead analyst for cereals and oilseeds. Sorry, Helen, but that was actually... I read what's put in front of me. So what is the planting and variety survey in a nutshell?
Hey Phil. The survey is there. It's an early look at what crops have actually made it into the ground. And so taking that forward a step, what could be produced at the coming harvest? We do an early survey of planting intentions back in the autumn, but we know things have potentially changed because the economics have been challenging and people are considering their options to some extent. And that can vary across the country. So we're aiming to pull that together and go, okay, how has that changed for you in regions of England and within Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland? And then what does that mean for the national picture? Could we have more or less available from the coming harvest than people might be expecting? From that, then taking that stage further, is there an impact? Do you need to rethink or be in closer contact with your preferred merchants or grain traders about how you might be thinking about selling your crops this year? I suppose the bit that comes to mind for me is if there is, say, a bigger area been planted in your part of the world, does that mean potential for greater supplies? And so do you need to be sort of on the phone earlier with your contacts to be thinking about what could be coming and how you might want to position it and what homes might you want to be looking to send that to and those sorts of things?
We recently released the first arable crop report. So how does this differ to that?
The crop report that you've mentioned was data collected for us by contractors, agronomists and other researchers across the country to give us a snapshot of how crops are looking at the moment, how they've come through the winter. Yeah, with it being such a wet winter, we really wanted to understand, was there a detrimental impact or were things generally holding up pretty well after the winter? So that's sort of looking at how crops are looking, what their potential is and what sort of areas are we watching. The disease pressure being the main thing that's sort of been creeping up and is in focus at the moment. Whereas the area looks then at how much is in the ground and together using that to then think about what the sort of total crop size might be as we go forward. So yeah, we're asking people to submit to us what they grew in the ground last year, the areas they harvested, and what they are intending to harvest this year. So what I mean by that is it's not so much an issue this year, but in some years you get where crops haven't made it, they were planted and didn't make it through the winter, say, and needed to be re-sown. We're looking at what's been re-sown then rather than what was originally planted. It's sort of what's in the ground as of now and is likely to make through to be harvested. So we can get that feeling of what sort of availability could there be come harvest.
And I think given everything that's going on in the market anyway, but specifically at the moment, there's a lot of volatility and uncertainty is our favourite word. I guess gathering this data and trying to get this forward look is really, really, you know, important for the sector. But there's a lot of draws on, you know, farmers' data and people want a lot of information from farmers. Why should farmers take part in this survey specifically?
You're right, there is a lot going on and a lot of demands on people's time. In terms of this one, this is sort of the first pre-harvest estimate, and the government will be putting out their estimates later on. We'll get sort of the first area information on England in usually mid to late August, but we won't get a full estimate of UK areas and productions until December. So the idea here is to give people a little bit of an earlier look at what could be coming. And then you're thinking about, with some of our other information that AHDB produces, so what stocks are likely to be held at the end of June, then what could be coming from this harvest? Okay, is this going to be a heavily supplied year or less so? And then thinking about those timings for marketing, and particularly when you look forward to next year as well, we know some of the challenges that are going on around domestic demand, particularly sort of the brewing, malting, distilling sector. What availability could there be? And then thinking about cropping intentions for Harvest 27. We want this information out for you guys to use before harvest, so you have time to consider that in case there is anything you may want to adjust with insights from your sort of local contacts about what's being grown and required locally to you for thinking ahead to next year.
How is the data kind of used once it's collected for the survey?
The data is firstly anonymised and summed up into regions, so we can use those comparisons between this year and last year to estimate what the area could be in each region. And then those regional and country data are added together to produce a UK total. So that's sort of like the background bit. It's only held... I'll go again because this is... classic being in the office.
That was the lights going off on Helen for anyone listening.
Sorry. We do our best to save energy. The lights turn off at periodic intervals. So here we go again. But then after that, in terms of how it's used, I know some of the farming unions use the data to look at where they may need to support their members. It's used by the wider trade and government then for planning purposes as well, thinking about what's needed. And for us as well, thinking about where we may need to help and support more in the year ahead if we know what the sort of crop size is, or maybe... so you can never rule out surprises at harvest, then how we take things forward within that as well.
So Helen, when will farmers be able to see the results from this survey, and what's the deadline for them submitting as well?
So in terms of getting the forms to us, if people could have sent their postal forms back by the 11th of May, but you do get a few extra days if you want to do it in online, that's the 15th of May, the survey will close there. And then we'll turn it around. We're going to have the results out mid-June. So exact date to follow, just depending on how long it takes us to crunch the numbers, but coming soon, mid-June.
Helen, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll include all the links to the survey form for people to fill out in the show notes. But I think we're going to take a short break, and we will soon hear from our exports team.
Hi, I'm Annabelle Twinbarrow, analyst at the AHDB, here with a look at the domestic dairy market for the week commencing 25th of May. GB milk volumes have now slipped into marginal year-on-year decline, and we are now past the seasonal spring peak. March deliveries were 0.1% lower year-on-year, and May-to-date volumes are down by 0.4%, though this is against a record high. In the latest UK wholesale price survey for May, prices remained under pressure, impacted by ample supplies of fat. The average price for mild cheddar was £2,940 a tonne, 1% lower than the last period. Bulk cream prices remain at half the value of a year ago. Minimal movement in the average month pricing gave an average for the month of £1,220 a tonne. The butter price moved down £200 a tonne, 6%, to £3,330 a tonne. However, SMP average prices did see another month of strength, ending at an average of £2,500 a tonne, a month-on-month increase of £140 a tonne. This is the only commodity that is more valuable than a year ago, as demand for protein remains strong. For the latest data and analysis on red meat, dairy and arable markets, head to ahdb.org.uk and click on Markets and Prices.
You're listening to The Ag Show with me, Hannah, and Phil. Please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you, as always. Email address is agshow@ahdb.org.uk. And we're joined by Jonathan Eckley and Lucy Randall from our Exports and Trade Development team. We're talking about what these guys get up to day to day. And we've already alluded to some of the depth and the different work that goes on in these teams. I wanted to talk a little bit more about you guys and all the people involved on the ground in making trade happen and how we support our levy payers that are involved in exports and trade access. How many people are in the team?
Okay, so yeah, export, look, is a key area of work across AHDB. So the total number of people working on international trade is actually 15 people. So within the remit under my team, obviously market access is an important part of that. So very, very technical. So meat scientists working there. Obviously Lucy leads on our dairy work, so that's in the trade development arena. And then in the red meat side, which is really established in AHDB, I've actually got 5 people working on that international trade development. Now, all those roles are UK-based, and that red meat sector, we're looking at some of a regional structure there. So I have somebody looking after the Americas, which is mainly the USA, Canada and Mexico. And then obviously the Middle East has been an important market in West Africa for carcass balance. So somebody looking after that region. And then further afield is Asia, particularly important with, you know, Asia taking nearly 50% of our pork exports. The only people AHDB has based overseas on the AHDB team is France is obviously a really, really important market for us on beef and lamb. So I have a wonderful team of 3 people based in Paris who are working with the trade over there, business to business marketing. And then in addition to that, obviously the international marketing piece is quite important. So there's 2 people based in HQ up at Coventry leading on the international marketing to support the trade development work that Lucy and my teams are involved with. And just to extend that reach, and I know Lucy may cover this in more detail, some really good examples of people on the ground, like we talked about in the Middle East. So we do stretch that reach. We haven't got a resource to have people in all the important markets to us. So we work through a network of agencies that we procure, whether that's in Northern Europe or the amazing Holly Chen, who doesn't actually work for AHDB, but works 100% on AHDB work in that all important market of China.
On our side of it, there's sort of 2 of us who work in the UK team. And then very importantly, we've got our overseas representatives who are effectively a bit like the agency network that Jonathan has on the European side of it for red meat. They have actually been with us sort of 18 months or so. They're as a result of sort of a collaboration that we had with the Department for Business and Trade on the Dairy Export Fund. And it's actually something that we agreed and co-funded between us. But which is now 100% on AHDB. So we went from, we actually had 3, one in the US, one in the Middle East and one in Asia. We're now down to the Middle East and Asia as AHDB is now 100% for the paying for these guys. So it's really key for us to make sure that we're maximising what we're doing in these markets. And I think, you know, they have been really key for us. They've been a bit of a game changer, I would even extend to say, on the export side of it. Just that sort of one-to-one knowledge, that one-to-one relationships, understanding the culture in those markets, being able to coordinate. I mean, I just counted up, we've done over 20 pieces over the last 18 months. We've done over 20 pieces of activity that wouldn't have been done without those guys. I think we worked out is we've introduced 20 to 25 new products into retailers over the last 18 months through retail promotions and things like that. So these guys are really, you know, really on board, working 100% full time for us. And I think, you know, they've been key for us. And I think, Jono, you guys during COVID, having your European agents was really key for you, having that, you know, having those people in market when we couldn't get anywhere as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, the international MA business is all about relationships, and whether that's between businesses to business or from an ASDB point of view, relationships with importers and distributors in market. So those local connections are really, really important to the work we do, having a really good understanding of the markets they're operating in and, you know, who's in that market to help connect people. And obviously, you know, we talked about a dynamic world. If there are shocks in the world like we've got right now, or there was with COVID, having people in place in those strategic markets to maintain that relationship and that doing the business is really important to us.
You talk about COVID, and obviously that has changed the world, because we're now talking on a podcast, which there's been a boom in podcasts since COVID because people can talk remotely and record wherever they are. But the exports team still does a lot of face-to-face work, and I understand that's really important. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, if you go back to COVID, you know, we got into that digital space pretty quickly, and people were really excited about that, and it worked really well for a period of time. And then we found, you know, the best events we could do. We had an event in Japan, for example, where we got 70 buyers in a room in Japan, and we were able to dial in and talk to them, which obviously delighted to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do that. But that space soon got quite fatigued. And then as the world opened up in the Western Hemisphere and then across to Asia, that face-to-face connection became really apparent. And the appetite from that, from both a UK exporter point of view and an in-market supply chain stakeholders, was really apparent from 2023 onwards. And, you know, Lucy would be a great example of that, of the hours she spent travelling the world back then, as I did, to re-establish those connections, because being able to sit down with people, whether it's on a, you know, stand at a trade show that are strategically important to us, or an event showcasing the product, doing that face-to-face stuff is really important. And we all know, you know, the digital stuff is great. It's much easier to do the digital stuff when you've actually met people face to face. So while, you know, maybe the 2023 years where it was crazy reconnecting are not with us right now, that being able to talk to people face to face, and of course, both with meat and dairy products, we have a tactile product. We need people to touch and taste it. So that all comes together as, you know, those events we run, whether it's a trade show that's strategically important in China or a cheese tasting event in America, it's really important that those things still happen to get those people together to establish and build on those relationships.
I think that was really interesting, actually, because I think before COVID, you know, there were questions about, could we move this online? You know, it seemed that's where the way everywhere was going. And, oh, yes, this could be quite a good thing to do. It saves us money, etc. And I think COVID was a really good example of actually demonstrating how you can do a bit of it online, but in fact, it is the face-to-face and relationships. And we found that during that time, existing business sort of ticked along, but no new business really was done because they couldn't do that face-to-face, touch, feel, see the product, and also, you know, see you and create those connections. And in many, many cultures around the world, it is about relationships. It's about getting to know them, getting to know their family, getting to know their team. And then we talk business. And that is key to doing international business. So I found that it was a bit of a great reset for us in a way, because it kind of solidified what we'd already always thought, but thought we'd have to explore, that digital is not totally the way forward.
And what about the travel element? Because on the surface, people might think it's quite nice flying off on planes and travelling around the world, but I'm guessing the reality is quite different to that.
It's always a fun one for us. I mean, it's hard. It's a lot of time away. It's a lot of time to get to a lot of these places. You know, you're talking, and especially with them going longer around Iran, or fuel, conserving fuel, you know, flight times have got longer as well. So an 8 hour is now a 10 hour, 11 hour trip. And it's a lot, you know, you're away a lot, you're away weekends, you have killer jet lag, you land, you work. And it's generally all day with clients and then client in the evening as well. It's not as glamorous as everybody thinks it is. It's kind of doing your day job on steroids, effectively. And you do run on adrenaline. I mean, I often find that I come back and you crash a little bit because you run on adrenaline for a week. Just keep going. And then you find you come home and you're talking too much to everybody. And you can hear yourself going, just calm down.
I'm guessing as well, sometimes you're in the air longer than you are on the ground on these trips.
I mean, if we're doing trade shows, generally not. But yes, sometimes that can happen.
Yeah, look. We travel, that's what we do, right? And we're incredibly lucky to do that. But once you've done it as much as the team have, particularly myself and Lisa, it's not quite as glamorous as it sounds. So I'll give you an example. You know, I was in Tokyo where we did an event just a month ago. I had 3 nights in Tokyo. It was about 19 hours to get there because I had to fly somewhere via somewhere else because direct flights are so expensive. And of course, that window of getting across to Asia is pretty narrow right now because you can't go over Russia or the Middle East. And then I had 24 hours in Hong Kong and home. So probably in door to door from Asia, it's 24 hours coming door to door. It's not glamorous, but it's, you know, look, it's what we do and it's what we enjoy doing. Not necessarily the travel, you know, sitting on an aircraft, you never get that time back, but it's about that face-to-face contact and it's about the people. It's about talking to those importers in Japan when you're there for that time. And also it's a great time to continue building relationships with the UK exporters that are also there, getting themselves there to meet these people for us to host an event, to get them in front, to do those discussions. And that's what drives certainly me to do that, because it's about the people. And you can only do that face-to-face.
It says here, Johnny won't ever let us forget his suitcase that was last seen in South Africa 14 years ago. Lucy, have you got any other similar tales of woe from your travels?
Oh, yeah, quite a recent one, actually. And to be honest, it involved Jono. So I think there's a pattern there, without a doubt. So we had a bit of a nightmare trip to go out to Dubai for the Gulf Food Show. And I was actually travelling with Jono, and our flight from the UK, which was direct, was cancelled. So they rebooked us to go via Paris. So we landed in Paris and got there waiting to board. Crew were on board, everything. And then last minute they said, oh, political situation, we can't fly now. So we had to quickly get in touch with our travel agent and resort flights, got the last 2 seats out, I think it was, on another flight to get out there. And of course, our luggage never caught up with us. So I was without it for 4 days. Johnny was without it for 3 days. You know, you're getting in later, you're having to rearrange things. And I blame Johnny for that because clearly it's a pattern with him.
I am obviously incredibly bitter about that suitcase. I last saw it in 2012 in Johannesburg Airport. So the moral of the story really is getting hand luggage and don't travel with Jono.
On a more positive note though, Jono, opposite to losing things, you've also gained something recently, I understand, which is the freedom of the City of London. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. Yeah, I'm honoured. A month ago, I was clothed as a liveryman of the Worshipful Company of Butchers down in London, which is one of the City of London's livery companies. And there's 100 of those, with the Butchers Company being number 24 on the list. So I was clothed in Butchers Hall. And as part of that, I've been granted the freedom of the City of London. A wonderful accolade. It's a great community within Butchers Hall of like-minded souls related to the meat industry, which is what I've been done for probably too many years to remember. But look, it's an honour to be inside and be proposed to become part of that. And it's a great opportunity for, there's got a great venue in London and, you know, occasionally having some networking opportunities with people of a similar mindset. And it's a great way of gaining insight on what's happening both in the UK market, but also wider afield on those international markets that are so important to my work and Lucy's work on the dairy side as well.
Well, thoroughly deserved and congratulations. I've got to ask though, do you get any perks from the freedom of the city? Do you get to run a few sheep across a bridge or anything the like?
Look, it's mainly ceremonial, but that is one of the privileges I can do, that I can now drive sheep across Blackfriars Bridge, and that does happen once a year. So we'll see if I can get myself aligned for that and go along to support it.
I think we need to do that.
Yeah, I want to see that happen next year, Jono.
Well, Phil, I think that's probably all we've got time for this week. We've been all over the world. We've spoken to the exports team. We've learnt about market development. And even in our own backyard, we've spoken to Helen about planting and variety survey.
So, Hannah, did Phil pass the test? Is he going to be welcome back for the next show? Or are you going to pick up the sledgehammer and do a bit more concrete breaking up thinking of him?
I'm worried now. She's laughing.
He's definitely passed the test, but you know, Charlotte is irreplaceable. See you next week. Bye.